across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
On the programme today, we talk about the past, the present, and the future. We hear from a man who was shot in both legs in 1994 by the IRA. 30 years later, he hasn't got a penny in compensation. We hear why. We also talk a lot about politics. We talk to Gareth Gordon, the only TV journalist to interview Sue Gray, who's top of the political agenda in London this week. And we talk about the DUP. Is it time for the party to change its name? Never, 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 some DUP supporters might say. But others think the party should at least think about it. Have a listen. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. It's Mark Simpson in the hot seat today. Lots to talk about in politics, my favourite subject. And this suggestion from a former DUP advisor that the party needs a brand new name. What do you think? Let us know. We're going to talk about that later in the programme. We're also going to talk about Sue Gray and why she is now, somewhat bizarrely some might say, top of the political agenda in London. We're going to talk to the local journalist who knows her best, our very own Gareth Gordon. We may even ask him about this possible DUP rebrand too. But first, a story that's about the past here, it's about the present, but it's also about the future for one man. He was shot in both legs by the IRA in 1994, just before the IRA ceasefire. But he still hasn't received any compensation 30 years later. He's appealed to the Victims Payment Board to accept that he is entitled to money because he was a victim of the Troubles. For 3 decades, he has lived with permanent injuries, excruciating injuries. One of his legs is actually shorter than the other now. Back in 1994, he was ordered out of a bar by a gang of IRA men, told to lie down on the ground, and then he was shot. He thought he was going to die, but he survived, only just. He was 26 at the time. Now, victims of the Troubles, as we know, are now entitled to compensation. But should he qualify? Well, he has appealed for his case to be approved.
I have not got one penny, Mark. I applied for this scheme almost 3 years ago, and from that day to this day, I struggle to live. That's 30 years. And I've suffered. I've physically and mentally suffered from the day and hour it happened to me.
I should point out that's not his real voice. He doesn't want to reveal his identity because he still lives in the area where the shooting happened and is afraid, he says, of the consequences for him and his family for speaking out, even, what, 30 years later? So his words there were spoken by a member of the Nolan team. We're going to hear more from that man in a moment. But let's just call him Paul. Let me give you a little bit more background and a bit more detail. He applied 3 or 4 years ago for compensation to the Troubles Permanent Disablement Scheme. He was initially turned down, but then was later approved following an appeal. Then last month, and we can't find any evidence of this happening before to anyone else, even though he had won his appeal, he was told his case was now being reviewed. So it's back to square one, and the bottom line, no money. He's being supported by the Wave Trauma Centre. They believe his story, and they believe, like him, that this review is linked to new guidance last year. It's complicated stuff, but bear with me. And it outlined that some paramilitary-style attacks fall within the definition of a Troubles-related incident, and some don't. So how would you distinguish between them? One guy shot in the knees by the IRA gets money. Another guy, maybe the same week, doesn't get money because the circumstances were different. We'll get into that later. But first, let's hear from Paul about what happened to him 30 years ago.
I got shot in 1994.
What were the circumstances?
Well, I was took out of a club. I was took outside and I was shot in both my legs. It turned out, what you were told, my father was told, that it was established that it was all mistaken identity.
And tell us about being shot. Tell us exactly what happened.
Well, I was in a bar And I was there, and then masked men came in. They took me outside and just shot me. Nothing was said, nothing else. They just took me outside and shot me.
Did you think you were going to die?
I did. I did. I thought I was just going to lie there and bleed to death. I didn't know whether they were going to come back and shoot me again, or I was just going to lie there in fear for my life. A while later, an ambulance came and brought me to the hospital, and I was in a bad way. I was on morphine for a long time. I was in hospital for a long time. And as I say, it was established later on that it was mistaken identity.
And what were your injuries then, and do you still feel the injuries now?
I do. I've never been able to work from the day it happened to me. I have one leg shorter than the other. I have a twisted back. I have mental health problems from it.
Do you know which organisation carried out this attack?
Yes. Yeah. It was the IRA.
And did anyone from the IRA or from the Republican movement explain to you why it happened?
Not to me. Personally, no. It was my father was approached, and he was told that it was mistaken identity.
Who were they looking for?
A lot of other things was happening to a family member of mine, and he didn't believe in their beliefs, and he wasn't prepared to give them money.
On the basis that he wouldn't pay the IRA protection money?
Yes.
So to be absolutely clear, you believe they were looking for another member of your family who had refused to pay protection money. The IRA came into a bar one night looking for another member of your family. They mistook you for them, and you were shot in both legs, and you've had pain ever since.
Yes, I've had mental health problems since it, Mark.
So, like many other people, you're a victim of the Troubles.
Yeah.
And there are schemes for people like you.
That's correct. And I've ran into a dead end. I applied for the pension from the Troubles Permanent Disability Scheme that opened in 2021. I applied for it on the 19th of October, 2021. And they refused me it. And I appealed it on the 30th of March, 2023. And I won my appeal. And then on the 16th of August, we got an email to my representative from WAVE to say that the panel wants my original decision looked at again. They didn't give me a reason why, and my representative from WAVE says she's never, in all of her days, doing these things. And I know it's a new scheme, but any appeal that she's ever done, when you win your appeal, that's it. You've won your appeal.
Have you anything on paper which tells you the reason why you haven't qualified for this scheme?
No, I have not. It's been proved that it was the IRA who done it. It's been proved that it was mistaken identity. So if that's not Troubles related, I don't know what is, Mark.
How's it been proved that the IRA did it?
Well, in the appeal, the appeal panel was happy to say that I was entitled to it. And they came out and said that they believed it to be the IRA, the way it happened. Masked men coming into a Republican area. Nobody does that bar the IRA.
Possibly they want more proof that you were a victim of mistaken identity. Can you give them any proof?
Well, it was my father who was told this. And my father's passed away. And you can't go to an organisation and say, would you give me something to say this is mistaken identity? You can't talk to these people.
So you haven't got a penny from this scheme yet?
I have not got one penny, Mark. I applied for this scheme almost 3 years ago, and from that day to this day, I struggle to live. Never mind doing anything else. I struggle to get out of bed. I struggle to walk at times. I feel the strain, Mark. As I say, I've been trying to get this scheme for 3 years, almost 3 years here. You know, I couldn't go out and get a job, get a good wage coming in into my home and provide better for my kids and my wife. I can't do that. And that's the thing. I would love to be able to drop in the morning, go out to work, bring in a decent wage from a family. But it's just unfortunate that I can't physically or mentally do that through no fault of my own.
If the people who are behind this scheme are listening, what's your message to them this morning?
Well, I would just love for you to be in my shoes today and see what way your life would be and what way you would feel about this whole thing. That's 30 years. And I've suffered. I've physically and mentally suffered from the day and hour it happened to me. And I still struggle with life. in general, today.
In terms of the process, is it over yet? Have you got a date for another hearing, an appeal?
Yeah, and the panel wants the original decision to be looked at again on the 9th of October.
Have you been told that if ultimately you are successful, how much money will you get?
No, they don't tell you that. It works on a percentage based on your physical and your mental needs. And
you must have some sort of idea.
The way it works, Mark, the minimum is like £1,000. But you could get up to £5,000 a year. It just starts off like that, like 20, 30, 40%. Just right up, all the way up to 100%. It's just different scales.
Just finally, what happened to you was horrific. It was barbaric. Was it definitely troubles related?
100% it was. And their original panel decided to say that they were happy that it was troubles related. They were happy it was the IRA who done it, and they were happy that it was mistaken identity.
So what do you think? Should Paul be given compensation for what happened to him almost 30 years ago to the day? You know the phone number, you know the text number. Let us know on the Nolan Show today. Let's ask Alison Morris, who's the Belfast Telegraph security correspondent, what she thinks in a moment. But first of all, the victims campaigner, Jude White. Jude, what do you think? Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mark. That's a pretty harrowing tale to be broadcast in 2024, considering we're 26 years into a peace process, and this issue of victims and legacy still dominates, you know, the news media. One of the interesting things about this pension was that it took 10 years of dreadful and endless argument on the victims' forum to get this from a theoretical idea up to government. And but Mike Nesbitt was one of the main runners behind it. But
we'll come to the bigger picture, Jude, just while people have fresh in their minds Paul's story. Yes or no?
Yes, he of course should be compensated without a shadow of a doubt. I find it absolutely incredible that he has been given the runaround, has to jump through every hoop, and just another example of how victims are treated with such disdain and such disrespect. There's no issue whatsoever, none at all.
Alison Morris?
I think it's more complicated than that, because Jude's right. When the discussions around this pension, you know, the discussions get stuck in the weeds for years in terms of what is the definition of a victim, who would be allowed this pension, who wouldn't be allowed this pension. And I know a lot of those say hard cases, big bad law, but a lot of those sort of hard cases were brought up, and that eventually was sorted out, that they were saying that the pension would not be eligible to anyone. I think the term they used had been injured by their own hands. So therefore, if anyone was injured without to shoot someone, and there was a, you know, they were shooting back at them and they were injured, well, then they wouldn't be entitled. If someone went to plant a bomb and they were injured, they wouldn't be entitled to it. But then that also left a grey area in terms of, would people who were maybe had previous convictions for other troubles related incidents, but then maybe were injured in a completely different attack. So, you know, people here can be perpetrators and victims at the same time. So you could have maybe been a member of an organisation involved in rioting when you were 18, and then being caught up in a bomb blast when you were in your 30s. So there was a load of grey areas that existed as well. It was always my understanding that the real difficulty was going to be with those sort of paramilitary style shootings, punishment style shootings, as they would have been called then, because they were never, rarely, if ever, claimed. You know, so there's no record. The panel have to work off records, and they include the medical records of victims, which obviously in this case would be very clear, because he'd been treated over a very long period of time for both his physical and psychological injuries, but then trying to establish the incident itself. And I can imagine, probably given the year that that happened and how horrific a year that was in terms of our troubles, that there's probably very little police records of that incident that give any kind of indication as who they believe was responsible. And he's already said the only claim or verification that he had that it came from the IRA was through a conversation with his father, who I trust is no longer here.
That's right.
To verify that. So that is probably where I imagine he's running into problems. It doesn't doesn't take away from the fact that nobody is doubting that he was injured and nobody is doubting that he has suffered the impact of that over a long period of time. But this is a panel having to deal with thousands of victims. Mm. And I have heard, you know, some horror stories. I think probably one of the cruelest things about the way the victim's pension was in the end devised is that they said that trauma only counted if you'd actually seen the attack. So
yes.
If your mother or father was murdered and you were two streets away at the time, you wouldn't be entitled to that pension. And the widows of a lot of people who weren't present during the attack but have trauma in the aftermath aren't entitled to it. And that is one of the really cruel things. So there is aspects of this pension that haven't worked. Mm. But there are aspects that have. And there's some people who suffer terrible injuries who have already received their pensions. There are a handful of people who were probably not entitled to it who have also received it as well by working the system cleverer than maybe they should have.
Yeah.
But in the long run, it was working quite well, albeit it's taken too long. In this case, I think he has fell into that really complicated grey area where if you can't prove it was a troubles-related incident, you don't have the records. And the records at that time, I imagine, are quite sketchy. Mm. And none of those things were claimed. Well, then you're in a real difficult. So you can't just say, oh, well, it was in a Republican area, so it had to be that. You know, yeah. That isn't, to me, doesn't sound like it. It's passing the test.
We have a bit more information, which I should have given out earlier, Alison. We have seen some of the paperwork. And when Paul's appeal was accepted, the panel accepted his story. They accepted it was the IRA. They could see his legs. They knew he was the victim. The grey area here, and this is maybe where Jude White can help us, is after he was accepted for compensation, this victims payment board came up with new criteria which differentiated between different types of paramilitary attacks. I don't know if you're aware of this. And this seems to be the grey area, and Paul has fallen on the wrong side of the line. Are you aware of this new criteria, Jude, that was issued in November 2023?
I wasn't actually until very recently, and I mean, I don't know the A to Z of it, but I mean, my initial reaction is we should be issuing a new criteria to try and get more people into this dynamic who can claim, you know, some monetary compensation either for physical or for psychological injury. What Alison said is quite correct. Overall, this payment scheme and this new victims board has got a neutral to positive response, and generally speaking, people are relatively happy with it. But I mean, this is all to do with attitude as well. If you want to find fault, we'll find it. The idea is to be a wee bit more magnanimous to victims. You know, these people have suffered.
Jude, I take your point, and I don't want to trivialise the issue by asking a question about me. So, where is the line? You know, I started work in this city in 1990. You know, I saw murder victims. I heard shots and saw victims. I saw trauma. I saw distraught relatives. You know, should I be entitled to compensation? I don't think personally I should, but there has to be a line somewhere. Where is that line?
Look, you do make a valid point. You and I and many people who saw many, many dreadful instances and that still haunt us perhaps down these years. I think there's a difference between being targeted by a state or a non-state actor, a deliberate and a malicious assault, be it with weaponry or on one's character. And I mean, I think we need, you know, to have a wee bit of sense about this. Everybody, I suspect, including yourself and myself, we can get in the queue here. But I think both of us would agree we're probably at the back of the queue when it comes to sort of real damage. And your point's right. I mean your point, and indeed your point's very valid. Where is the lane when a victim is not a victim? And I mean, that's really for our politicians to say what the Victims Commission did or what the Victims Forum did. It drew that lane and it said, for example, people injured in while carrying out an act were excluded, something that I totally disagreed with, by the way, but that was a recommendation that was sent to government. So, you know, some people are always going to fall into, you know, the crevasse of and be an unusual case. It's at that time I would appeal to this board, show a bit of magnanimity, show a bit of respect, a bit of love, and try and take these stories as they come. The story you articulated this morning, for me, is totally black and white. This man deserves compensation.
Well, I'm going to dig out the criteria. While I do that, Alison, give us your view.
Yeah, I suppose the difficulties that the pension board have is that there is only there's a limited pot of money. It will eventually run out, and it's trying to make sure that those really deserving cases get what it is that they're entitled to. I think that a lot of the people who were victims, and very wrongly victims, to that sort of vigilante style summary justice, which existed before the Troubles End, has continued, let's face it, long after them. We're still getting those type of attacks happening, you know, not as often, I thank goodness, but they do still happen. It's trying to work out, you know, which of those it can be verified it was actually Troubles related. And that is, that is where I have looked at the criteria. I read it yesterday, and I can see that there's an attempt, I suppose, to try and limit that pot of money so the people who are most deserving of it receive it.
Yeah.
And in this case, he should have actually received compensation at the time, given his injuries and given the extent of his injuries. That is something that should have been, and probably still should have been, the case now. And you do find that people who are subject to these type of attacks often don't get compensation because there's someone who might have had a trouble past themselves, and then the NIO were able to say, no, you're not entitled to anything. And that's always been the case, and that's always, I think, been wrong.
Gotcha.
In terms of how these cases are dealt with.
The team is good behind the scenes. They've found the actual criteria. Bear with me. This is important. Every word is important. This is what the criteria says from the victim's page. Payment board. It is important for the integrity of the scheme as a whole that a line is drawn somewhere in relation to the issue of what is and what is not a Troubles-related incident and vigilantism in a community. Alison, help me there. What is the difference between a punishment attack, as it was called back then, horrible phrase, we now call them paramilitary attacks, or barbarity? What is the difference between an attack that could be seen as vigilantes or Troubles related?
See, where they're trying to draw the line is they say that vigilante style violence would have taken place whether there was conflict here or not. You know, that was something that was happening before and has continued to happen afterwards. So they're trying to distinguish between those type of attacks and attacks that were carried out just because there was a conflict on in this place.
Yes.
And that's, I think, where they're trying to make the distinction.
That's it. Jude, what do you think?
Oh, I mean, fair play to your researchers there for getting that as a short. Oh, I think it's very mean-spirited. Very, very mean-spirited. You know, the difference between a Troubles-related assault and vigilantism. I mean, I can't imagine in any normal society where people are running around shooting the legs of kids and low-level drug dealers and people convicted of antisocial behaviour. This wouldn't happen in any other society. And in my view, from the late 60s right through to the Good Friday Agreement, they should be deemed. The problem is, I suppose, you're still getting some of this behaviour nowadays, but really, wouldn't it be wonderful if you were reporting this morning from 20 victims who came to you and said, listen, I want to do a story about how well I've been treated by the victims, you know, board. I want to highlight that I put in my evidence. I went. I was treated with great respect, and I've got my compensation. This is attitude. It's mean spirited. If that's what your researchers have found, I think.
Well, we've got a statement from the Victims Payment Board. Let me read it. Not all of it, because they're not able to comment on the detail of individual cases which are proceeding through our process, they say. But they say under their regulations, the panel has the right to review individual cases should they consider it necessary. And this is the good news for Paul. An applicant will also have the right of appeal on all review decisions. So even if this review, this current review, I think it's what, the third time the panel have looked at Paul's case, he can still appeal. Some interesting figures here, Jude, I'll give you the final word on this. A total of almost 10,000 applications have been received already. Around 1,200 cases being determined eligible for a payment, and the scheme's already paid out more than £50 million, Jude.
Well, I mean, first of all, congratulations to the government for getting for taking the advice of the Victims Forum and for going ahead and doing this. Look, there's a lot more to be done. Governments and NGOs and people, try to just understand that none of these people who made these applications went out to get shot or blown up or beaten up or And just, it's all to do with attitude. A bit more, a bit less mean-spiritedness would go a long way in this society. That's it, Mark, I feel.
That's Thought for the Day with Jude White. Jude, thank you as always. Thanks as always too to Alison Morris from the Belfast Telegraph. Stay with us after 9:31. We're going to be talking about politics. We're going to be talking about Sue Gray. She's the talk of the town in London, but we know her very well in Belfast. And we're going to be talking to our own political correspondent, Gareth Gordon. Thanks for sticking with us. You're going to enjoy this next story because we're going to get under the bonnet of the Sue Gray story. She's been talk of the town in London. She was on the 10 o'clock news last night. A big row has broken out over her salary. She earns more than Sir Keir Starmer, even though he is her boss. She's his chief of staff at Downing Street. She used to be a senior civil servant here in Belfast, very well known, I would say, to every politician at Stormont. But she's only ever done one TV interview. And if you watch the 10 o'clock news last night, it's basically the only pictures they have of her is that famous interview, or some might say infamous interview, with Gareth Gordon, our own political correspondent. And one of the questions Gareth asked her, this was, what, 3 years ago? She had just missed out on getting the top job at Stormont as head of the civil servant. And Gareth asked Sue Gray why she thought that was.
I suspect people may have thought that I am perhaps too much of a challenger or a disruptor. I am both. And perhaps I would bring about, you know, perhaps there's going to be too much change.
And Gareth, being Gareth, asked her another question too.
I've even had someone put it to me that you are a spy.
I know you've had that put to you. I think if I was a spy, I'd be a pretty poor part of spy if people are talking about me being a spy.
Good morning, Gareth Gordon.
Good morning, Mark Simpson.
What do you make of all this?
Oh, you couldn't write Sue Gray's story. You couldn't make it up. If you brought it to a publisher, they would say, never on your Nelly. I mean, for those who don't know, Sue Gray has been a lot of things in her time for a woman who doesn't do interviews and shies away from publicity. Among those things, she's married to a very well-known country western singer from Portaferry. They for a little while, and she for lots longer, because he wasn't much good at it, according to her. They ran a pub just outside Newry, of all things, which I think is probably where the spy allegations or the spy stories come from. She said, she told me in that interview that her husband wasn't very good at running the pub, made him grumpy, so she sent him back to London and she ran it herself. She's been, among other things, the head of the ethics and propriety section of the Cabinet Office, in which she has had the power to make or break the many political careers. She then came to Northern Ireland, a lot of surprise that she would take what many thought was a demotion to run the Department of Finance, permanent secretary. Some even speculated then it was in a period of suspension, the Stormont was down, and she was coming back to essentially run Northern Ireland. That didn't happen because she didn't get the job when devolution came back of the head of the civil service here, which is the job she wanted, and that's the job she's talking about in that interview with me, and that's when we did the interview. I personally haven't met her since, although there is a line of communication, I'll say that. A lot of people were amazed that she did that interview. She possibly had a score or two to settle, and she certainly didn't put a tooth in it when she did the interview. I couldn't believe she A, did the interview, and B, went so far. There was astonishment, and there still is, in the civil service here in London and in Dublin, I know, that no civil servant, I'm told, has ever done an interview like this before or since. Sue Gray is an incredible character. She was once known as the most powerful civil servant you've never heard of. You certainly couldn't say that now. And she finds herself, I imagine, very uncomfortably, although I haven't a clue because I haven't talked to her, at the centre of a story. An advisor never should become a story, but for whatever reason, somebody wants to make her a story. The tabloids see her as a conduit really to get at Keir Starmer, I'm sure, and there are some in Downing Street. You heard Tom Kelly, our old boss, and a man who knows all about Downing Street on Good Morning Ulster earlier on. Clearly there is unhappiness in Downing Street among some people at the role that she has, a very powerful role, and the story that Chris Mason broke yesterday is that she now gets paid a little more than the Prime Minister. A lot of people get paid more than the Prime Minister, to be fair, but not normally his Chief of Staff, you have to suspect. So somebody wants to get Sue Gray or somebody wants to get Keir Starmer, but either way, it's an uncomfortable place for both of them.
I know you're unlikely to get another interview in the near future, but who knows? But if you did, what do you think she would say? I know you don't know her really well, but you know her. How do you think she's feeling this morning?
Well, I think there's two sides to this. Sue Gray I know a little bit is not the character that's portrayed normally in the media. She is, as we would say, good crack. She likes a laugh. I imagine if you're on the wrong side of her, you would see a different side. I have never seen that side, thankfully. And she's a bit mischievous, hence the interview, hence what she said in the interview. So she quite enjoys a little bit of that, I would imagine. But this is a different league, I would have thought. She is currently the most controversial woman in politics. Yeah. I don't imagine she ever wanted to be that. Mm. What would she say? Go and leave me alone. But then if she didn't want this sort of publicity, there is a way out. She didn't need to take the job in the first place, or she could quit the job. So all of those things in play. I am going to the Labour conference in Liverpool at the weekend. And to be honest with you, I don't imagine I'll run into Sue Gray, because the last thing she would be well advised at the moment to keep the head down, I would have thought.
Gareth, you and I are old enough to remember the late 1990s when you had Alistair Campbell, who eventually had to go from Downing Street because he, as you outlined earlier, no advisor ever wants to constantly be the story. The other parallel perhaps here is Mo Molum. And people, and you and I heard this at the time, felt there was this campaign against her, fed by the fact that she was a powerful woman. And yep, some newspapers just couldn't handle that.
Well, it could be all of those things. I simply don't know. As I say, the papers like the Mail and the Telegraph, I'm sure, and others as well, you can name, do see Sue Gray and the Sue Gray story as a line of weakness. Keir Starmer has had a bit of a bumpy ride since taking power, let's face it. The latest story, the one before the Sue Gray one, is that are all these suits and junkets he's been allegedly given by a party donor. Not a great thing for any politician, and certainly not a great thing for a Labour Prime Minister, you would have to be said. So he is, even though he's got this massive majority, and there's no election looming for a very long time, you would have to say, he personally is under more fire 2 months or whatever it is into his premiership than you would imagine he would have been. And some of it, you would have to suspect, is his own making or the making of the Labour Party.
Yeah, well, you'll enjoy the conference at the weekend in your favourite city, Liverpool. Are you going to see Liverpool while you're there?
Well, you know what?
The BBC's most famous Manchester United fans going to Anfield. Let's move on.
I would have thought that's your title. Well, I am going to see them.
Oh, my goodness.
A cousin of mine texted me last weekend. He knew I was going. I think he got the wrong game.
Oh, my goodness.
And he said, what a great day to be at Anfield. Though he didn't call it Anfield because Forest beat them last week.
Yes.
And I had to say, sorry, you're a week early. So can lightning strike twice?
I know that cousin. I can name that tune in one. I want to ask you one more thing before you go, because not only do you remember the 1990s, you remember the 1970s when the DUP was born. The Paisley era is now over. You may have seen this article in the Belfast Telegraph talking about Lee Reynolds, a former advisor and a pretty senior figure within the DUP back in the day. He has written, I think, is it the Critic magazine, talking about maybe, just maybe, it's time for the DUP in the 2020s to change its name. Discuss.
Well, there's a lot more to the article than that. I have just literally speed read it. In fact, I didn't get it finished when I was waiting for you to come on to your programme. The DUP is in a state of flux, and it's not a state of flux, it's of its own making. The last election, the last general election in July, was the worst election the DUP have had since it became the biggest party in unionism, certainly the biggest in two decades, or just over two decades. And it can't blame it all on what's happening with the Geoffrey Donaldson situation. There are other things going on. The DUP isn't possibly, some would say, moving with the times. And it finds itself in a position, and unionism generally finds itself in a position where it doesn't need to be. And I think when this period ends, it's got to do a lot of sorting out and challenging itself as to which direction it wants to go in. Would a name change make a difference? Maybe, but probably there are those who would say there are other changes required as well. And we haven't time to go into them now.
Just tell us briefly, when is the DUP party conference? Because it might be a good place to do vox pops.
Saturday. So, I'm afraid I'll be at Anfield. But, so, Jane McCormick's going. So, okay. If you've any ideas, I'm sure Jane will be all ears. Although I'm sure she's thought of those ideas herself.
Gareth, thanks as always. We covered an awful lot there, from football to politics to the DUP party conference. Anyway, I'm not sure if Ulster Scots is going to be spoken at the DUP party conference. Probably will, somewhere along the line. Experts from the Council of Europe have today published a report that says these different languages other than English in Northern Ireland are proving very difficult to find. The Irish language seats street signs in some council areas. There's too big a challenge to put them up. The report also says that Ulster Scots speakers are in a very weak position in Northern Ireland. So why is that? Because as we know, language laws came into effect here in Northern Ireland in 2022 with the passing of the Identity and Language Act. So why do we not see more Irish, more Ulster Scots in official buildings and elsewhere? Let's talk to the UK member of the Committee of Experts, Rob Dunbar, the SDLP councillor, Carl White, and the TUV deputy leader, Ron McDowell. Rob Dunbar, let's start with you. We've got a Rob and a Ron. I'm getting all confused. Rob, what do you make of this Council of Europe report?
Well, I'm a member of the Committee of Experts, and I participated in both the state visit, which we did in February, and the preparation of the report. The points you raise are very interesting. You're absolutely right that the legislation received royal assent in 2022. But in terms of the implementation of the legislation, there have been great delays because, as you'll know better than I and better than the other experts, there's essentially been no government in Northern Ireland and until very recently. So part of the report is some recommendations for things that the Committee of Experts, that the Council of Europe would like to see implemented as quickly as possible.
Like what, Rob? Give us a couple of examples, if you can.
Well, relating to the legislation, one is simply to implement fully the Identity and Language Northern Ireland Act. For example, the Act creates two commissioners, one for each language, and those commissioners have not yet been appointed. There is long-standing question about an old piece of legislation from the 18th century that effectively makes it impossible for other languages to be used in court. That is supposed to be, under the 2022 Act, abolished, that old piece of legislation, to allow progress in this area. And that's not been possible because, again, it requires government action. So hopefully with the executive and the assembly in place, progress can be made on these issues.
Rob, you've given us two specific examples there of where these languages could be more visible or more audible in courts in terms of having language commissioners in place. Anywhere else, what would you like to see around, you know, our major cities, whether they be Belfast or Lisburn or Derry or Newry?
We don't really, in the report, and the Committee of Experts doesn't really recommend what you should be doing. It's an international treaty with obligations that have been chosen by the UK government. So we assess the extent to which those obligations, which the UK has taken on, are being fulfilled. One other area, for example, where we recommend action is with regard to a language strategy for both Irish and for Ulster Scots. These are long-standing commitments that have not been taken forward, again, partly because of problems in the establishment and okay. continuity of the legislature, and also developing a strategy for recruitment of teachers Irish. Another big issue, it's a problem that faces all of the minority languages in the UK, and there was a report from, as part of the report, the Committee of Ministers, the supreme decision-making body in the Council okay. of Europe, made recommendations with regard to all of the minority languages in the UK, Welsh, Scottish Gaelic, and so forth, Manx, where teacher shortages, the lack of training of teachers is limiting the further development and the meeting of demand for minority language education. So these are some of the things that we've been saying. But we don't come in and say you should have more of this or more of that. That's really for the UK and the authorities in Northern Ireland to decide for themselves.
Rob, that's very helpful. Let's unpack a bit of that with our two politicians, starting with the SDLP councillor, Carl White. First things first, were these language commissioners, Carl?
Well, you need to ask the executive parties, Mark, who aren't on your show and don't seem to be on this show very often, to explain yet another delay faced by minority language speakers, Irish language speakers and those who speak Ulster Scots. This Act was passed 2 years ago, and these people aren't in office. And I think that explains the patchwork approach to language rights that we see identified in this very detailed and comprehensive report, which I would urge everybody to read,
yeah.
because it certainly shows how Northern Ireland, in a UK context, falls behind both counterparts in Wales and in Scotland, who are streets ahead in terms of their provision of language rights for minority language speakers.
And Carl, sorry to interrupt, but I suppose the most recent example was Grand Central Station and the issue over whether or not Translink were obligated to put Irish language and say, Ulster Scots signs as well.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the opening of Grand Central Station has been somewhat tarnished and mishandled by Translink and their approach to that issue. I think if you walk into the Guildhall in Derry, and every single sign is written in three languages, English, Irish, Ulster, Scots. I don't see why, and that's optional, that's that council decided to do that. I don't see why a similar approach couldn't have been taken in Grand Central Station. I think it's very interesting you read the report as well, Mark. And we talk about Irish a lot on the radio, and people like to take pot shots at it. But when you look at Ulster Scots, there's actually no adult provision for adult learning for Ulster Scots anywhere in Northern Ireland. And I was staggered to read that because I thought to myself, you know, we hear a lot about equality from minority languages. A lot of people criticise Irish language groups. Yet, actually, and I certainly spent a lot of time understanding the issues around Ulster Scots with 4 years on the Flags Commission. If I wanted to go and learn Ulster Scots today or this, you know, this coming September, or this month to get a course this year, I actually can't do it. I really couldn't believe that's the state of affairs we're in.
Ron McDowell, what's your view on all of this?
I think that Irish language has been well bashed out across the media over recent months. And looking at the report that comes from this Council of Europe, it makes me particularly glad that I voted for Brexit back in the day. Now, I know that the UK are still members of this Council of Europe, but they're not living in the real world with some of their recommendations. It would cost millions to implement their recommendations, and for what is basically, from the census, a 0.3% of people in Northern Ireland who use Irish as their main language. They're trying to introduce the Irish language as a main language in the country, when really it's a hobby, it's a heritage item, it's something to be cherished. It's not something that should have equality with English as the main language of the country. But what I would say, and there's no comparison between Ulster Scots or Ulster British traditions with the Irish language. The Irish language is a juggernaut in Northern Ireland. The recommendations that we see, even from this European Council, are recommending bilingual signs. There's no room for trilingual signs. It's bilingual Irish traditional cracked form place names that they quote. Even when you go back into Belfast City Council and the consultation that they have out at the minute, there's no room for an Ulster Scots strategy to exist beside that. The Irish language in Northern Ireland is all-consuming, and the costs for the implementation of all of this would be...
Sorry to interrupt. Direct that question then at Rob Dunbar. What's your criticism of the Council of Europe?
So the Council of Europe are really propagating an Irish language identity on Northern Ireland. There's nowhere for Ulster Scots to survive alongside the scale of this Irish Language Act.
Let Rob come back.
Well, I don't think that's true. What the report does and what the Committee of Experts do and what the Council of Europe do is to assess the obligations that the UK has taken on itself. So all of our recommendations are directed to commitments that the UK government made first in 2001. And we simply look to see what the UK government and the devolved authorities are doing to implement the commitments that they've undertaken themselves. So it's really not a case of the Council of Europe proactively trying to advance this or that agenda. It's a case of us taking a look at what the UK has signed up to and taking a view as to whether those commitments are being implemented. The Charter applies to both languages. There are a number of recommendations with regard to Ulster Scots as well. That's really how the treaty works.
Ron?
So basically what he said is we're only looking at what has been promised. We're not looking at the merits of our argument. They haven't put forward a merit-based case for dual language or Irish in Northern Ireland. They haven't put forward a merit-based costing of such a strategy. They haven't put forward a merit-based look at Ulster British, Ulster Scots community within Northern Ireland and the impact that the scale of the Irish Language Act would have upon that minority community. Basically what they've said is we're going to ensure that what the DUP and Sinn Féin signed up to a few years ago is going to be implemented, and that's just tinkering in politics. That's not with a care for language.
Well, maybe this all points to the executive and why they haven't come up with this Irish Language Commissioner or Commissioner for the Ulster Scots and Ulster British Tradition. Back to you, Carl White. We asked on the 9th of September when the whole issue of signage at Grand Central came up, we asked the executive office what's going on. We haven't got a reply yet. So what's that? Nearly 2 weeks now. Is it a row or they can't get the right people? Speculate for us.
Well, it's like many things that the executive and the office of First and Deputy First Minister presides over, which is a very difficult decision process verging on complete inertia. And I'm not surprised that these appointments haven't been made. And I certainly wouldn't be, you know, I expect we'll see trains at Grand Central Station a lot quicker than we'll see any decisions from the First and Deputy First Minister on this.
Have you any inside knowledge as a Belfast City Councillor on that, Carl, when those trees are going to start coming?
I don't know. We're an opposition party, Mark, so you know, you're more likely to get a response from that quicker than we will, and that's the way things are now. I think that organisations like Belfast City Council have gone ahead, regardless of the inaction from the executive, and taken decisions regarding minority languages. And by the way, anyone who wants to have an Ulster Scots sign, bilingual sign, erected on the street in Belfast can do so and should do so. There are other councils who are falling behind on the provision, and that's identified in the report. I think Ron has been a bit unfair to Rob's report. It's not there to make recommendations. It states facts, including the fact that none of the commissioners have been appointed, including those for Ulster Scots and British identity, not just the Irish language one. And actually, when you step back and look at this is a document about the United Kingdom. It's a document about devolved governments there. It's a document about the recognising the good work that's been done in other areas, Wales, Scotland, parts of some good things, but Irish. A bit to go about Ulster Scots, Cornish, Manx and those languages.
Carl, I'm going to be sacked. It's 5 to 10 on the Nolan Show and I haven't gone to the lines yet. Let's go to East Belfast. Craig, good morning. Apologies.
Good morning, Mark. No, I was just listening to the programme and I've listened on previous occasions about this Ulster Scots. Now, I grew up in the River Clyde, Ayrshire, and Ulster Scots is a dialect, as far as I'm aware, not a language. You don't put a sentence or a paragraph together in Ulster Scots. You just use different words. Like, for instance, I was brought up using the word cludgy instead of the toilet. And if you're listening to somebody talking, says, I can, that means, yeah, I know. Or a football throw-in was called a shy. It's just different words for different things.
Craig, thank you. You've educated us.
All the time.
You've educated us in Ulster Scots. Yeah. Is it a language or a dialect, Ron McDowell?
It's a language. It's a recognised language by the European Council, by Stormont, by the executive, by the European Commission. It's recognised as a language. And one of the things that folk are desperate to preserve is their own sense of identity. We've already spoken about trans. Like, one of the main resistances to Irish language and trans like, is the local community. It's an Ulster British community in the area who don't have an Irish identity and see that as an assimilation of their identity. But there are also other issues and defence of trans like, that are happening in the site that would probably push Irish language further down the list. The residents are having real issues with work at night time, the schedule, the things that are going on, the traffic around TransLink.
Yeah, Ron, tell us what's happening with the traffic. We've only got a minute left. We got a lot of calls about this yesterday. Anybody doing anything about the traffic around Grand Central? And then I'll ask Carl as well.
It's difficult. I had spoken with TransLink last week and asked them when we would be at the worst of this, and they have said that the worst is yet to come. I was talking to residents from Limfield Road, just at the edge of that, who have said it takes 45 minutes to get out of Sandy Road at the minute. We know that the work that's going on at the station is going on all night, that people can't sleep. There's work, there's lorries, there's machinery going at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning. Irish language at the TransLink site at the hub is the last thing on our mind at the minute.
Carl White, are you hearing that the worst is still to come in terms of traffic congestion around Grand Central?
Well, firstly, on the language issue at Grand Central, Mark, the Northern Ireland Government and North of Ireland, whatever term you want to use, has requirements regarding minority languages.
You have 30 seconds, Carl. Talk about the traffic if you can.
Authority. It runs the Transport Authority and has responsibilities regarding language. The traffic is a disaster. Yes, I don't think that, and I think Ron and I can agree on that.
Hallelujah!
It is very difficult and it needs fixed as soon as possible.
Are you doing anything about it?
Yeah, we are. I know all Belfast City Councils have been in touch with TransLink. I have as well. There are a range of issues regarding around the city. I've contacted Department for Infrastructure. We seem to be choked with roadworks right across Belfast, all of which seem to be happening at once. And there's been no planning or look at how we can actually sort of manage these over a period of time where drivers aren't completely blocked up every day.
Well, keep in touch with us on that issue. Thanks to Carl White, to Ron McDowell and Rob Dunbar. Stay with us. Lots more to come on The Nolan Show this Thursday morning.
Get the news.
Now, here's our question of the day. Will the DUP ever change its name? Never, 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 some might say. But a former advisor to Arlene Foster has said the party must consider changing its name. It says the DUP has become a negative brand and the name is outdated. This comes from not just anyone, but Lee Reynolds. He was a special advisor to the former DUP leader Arlene Foster. He used to be a key figure when it came to policy within the DUP. He used to be their director of policy. He's written an article in a magazine called The Critic, and it's given a lot of people some food for thought. I've already had one suggestion on text that they copy America, and rather than become the Democratic Unionist Party, they just become the Democrats. There's one idea. Have you any others? Let's speak to Mick Fealty, the editor of Slugger O'Toole, and the former DUP special advisor, David Graham. David, good morning to you first.
Good morning, Mark.
Just so that listeners know, it's geeks and anoraks like us that have maybe heard of Lee Reynolds. Maybe some of our listeners haven't, but he used to be a very significant figure within the DUP.
Yes, look, I think, Mark, Lee is probably one of the most, or was one of the most underrated backroom members of the DUP staff. Fiercely intelligent, certainly, you know, solid strategist, knew his way around the political world. So, you know, certainly I would value Lee's opinion, what Lee's saying. I don't entirely agree with all of it, but in saying that, I certainly get the gist of it. And fundamentally, he's hit the nail on the head.
Lee Reynolds used to be in the Ulster Unionist Party. He took on Jim Molyneux back in the 1990s. He wounded him. He didn't beat him. He then joined the DUP and became a councillor at Belfast City Council. So we're talking a significant figure here. David, you need to listen to him, do you not? And at least consider this as an issue, as someone with still a heart for the DUP.
Look, Mark, there's no doubt there are a lot of issues in there, and there's probably more than what I can contribute in a matter of a couple of minutes to sort of solving any of these issues. What I would say is, and I've said this on the programme before, unionism, in my view, as in if we break unionism right down to the fundamental of there's a border poll in the morning, you're walking into the privacy of a ballot box and you're voting to either remain part of the UK or voting to leave. You know, without being arrogant or in any way presumptuous, I believe if there was a border poll in the morning that the majority of people in Northern Ireland would vote to remain part of the United Kingdom. However, the problem is when it comes to political unionism, where a lot of those people who will vote to remain part of the UK, in my view, are spread across three unionist parties. And I think that if you were to mirror it with nationalism, who has two in the SDLP and Sinn Féin, three is spreading a thinning base, even thinner. Or people are voting for the Alliance Party, which Lee mentions, or people are not voting for parties at all, even though they're registered and they may come out in a referendum. So, you know, the brand of the DUP has taken a fair battering, to say the very least, over the last decade. And I think Lee highlighted, we've never replaced Peter Robinson. Peter Robinson, I believe, was the glue that kept a lot of things stuck together in the DUP. And he's right. I mean, I think that, you know, the DUP does need to look at its structures. I mean, fundamentally, and, you know, I say this as well as my experience at Linfield, where when you've got structures that have been in place for decades, when you've had the same faces in positions for decades, people don't like change. No. In fact, people aggressively oppose change. And I think that the difficulty is now, and Lee's highlighted, there are probably very few people that actually have power in the DUP. And I think he's highlighting that even from a time point of view, Mark, makes it very difficult. For example, Gordon Irons being Communities Minister and Director of Communications.
Yes. Or Director of Elections.
Sorry, Director of Elections, yeah. Pardon me.
Director of my swimming buddy. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. We've been out in East Antrim and it all went wrong in the end. We'll tell you about that tomorrow. Mick Fealty, back to the DUP. What do you think about a rebrand and a new name?
Well, you know, look, going back to Lee's analysis, I think the new name is a provocation. It's not necessarily... He's not saying, look, if you put a new sign above the shop, then everybody will forget it used to be the DUP and they'll think it's this other thing. That would be a disservice to the analysis that he's put in the Critic magazine, which I think comes down to two things. One, the DUP and other unionists need to recognise that demographically Northern Ireland has substantially changed. So many of the bedrock issues, including identity, you know, religious identity, all of the rest of it, that's beginning to break down. There's a sort of a hybridization, if you like, of people. And those people are no longer able to just stomach the kind of social conservative bedrock of traditional unionism. And, you know, they want something a bit more open, a little bit more liberal. And his case is that they're underperforming. It's not that that unionism is entirely unfit for purpose, but they're underperforming, and they're losing chunks of people either to non-voting. So that's one thing. And I think the other thing that David mentioned, there's a hollowing out of the party. Like, all of the power is now at the top and not at the bottom. And I think this is something all political parties, regardless of whether they're unionist or nationalist, really are suffering from in the modern day.
But 50 years is a long time. Maybe it's just my generation. You hear the DUP and you still do think of Paisley. I'm not sure if you Google the DUP, what image first comes up. Mm. But, Mick, do you not think the party should at least think about it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, they should think about it. I mean, look, the problem is we're now moving into a world where Catholics and Protestants are not as polarized as they used to be, certainly not east of the ban. You know, and you see that we've seen this for most of the 50 years that the DUP has been in existence. As people move out from inner city Belfast to the likes of South Antrim, Glengormley, Newton Abbey, or, you know, along our neck of the woods towards Hollywood, Bangor, all the rest of it, membership of the Orange Order drops. Integration with Catholic neighbours kind of begins to kind of grow. And there's a different sense of who people are. And some of what Lee is actually talking about here is, look, get with the project, get where the people are. The people are moving much faster than all of the political parties here. And what most people have tumbled, and he quotes the figures from the Westminster election, which I think ought to be of some reassurance to unionists who are a little bit nervous of change.
Mm.
You know, the total vote for unionist parties was 42%. The total for nationalist parties was still just 40%. In other words, there's no real shift, there's no real movement, and there's no real movement towards a united Ireland. Here's a moment to really start thinking about the future rather than worrying about the past.
I want to stick with the name issue, David Graham, because the party has changed unbelievably, incredibly, since the 1970s. Does it not make sense to rebrand it now?
Well, I think, Mark, rather than, I think Mick put it very nicely there, essentially changing the name above the door.
But it's important. It's important.
No, it's important, but I think it's actually what's behind that name. And I think for me, I've already mentioned it, when you've got three parties, and Mick's entirely right, if you almost put all three memberships or even all three elected memberships of the three unionist parties together and then allowed them to sort of walk through a door based on issues, you would actually find that there are people within the DUP who would be more comfortable in the TUV. There are people in the Ulster unionists who would be more comfortable in the DUP and vice versa. And I think that that's a challenge now, because Mick's entirely right. And it goes back to my initial point. Unionism is still in a strong position, in inverted commas. But when it comes down to voting, whether it be at council level or right through to Westminster, it's spread. South Antrim highlighted that. Mm. Lagan Valley highlighted that. And to a lesser extent, the likes of North Down did, where, again, the like of Alex Easton was able to win, albeit with endorsement from the DUP. So the issue here is not necessarily what you call any of the parties. I now am at the stage where I think there are too many unionist parties.
Ah.
And this idea, Mark, of let's all get together before an election and let's try to work something out where you put a square peg in a square hole.
Mm.
And then a week later, when we're all elected, let's go back to cutting the life out of each other in local councils or storming. That's short term, Mark, and that gives you a little bit of breathing space after an election. But for me, this is the first time where there's been a significant amount of time between elections.
3 years.
And I think it'll be really interesting to see what Gavin Robinson says at the weekend at the party conference.
Yeah.
Obviously, Lee's been quite, you know, strategic about when he said.
He always is.
And that hasn't happened by luck or chance.
No.
But I think the key thing is that you can talk all you want about unionist unity, unionist cooperation, unionist whatever, let's all change the name. But Mick's entirely right. The people, let's say, whose parents and certainly grandparents voted for DUP, Ulster Unionist, whatever case may be, that's now changed.
Yep.
And the big threat that unionism has is the amount of, in inverted commas, small unionists who go and vote for the likes of the Alliance Party or don't vote at all.
Yeah. I want to stick to the name issue. Sean's on the line. Sean, good morning to you. What do you think?
Good morning. I don't think it's going to be a planned name change. I think the name change will be forced upon them.
Okay.
So I think it's, as unionism thins, they're going to be forced to become one party, and whether it's as we know, the UUP are really an alliance of groups. They're different area groups that come together.
Yep.
I think you're going to be looking at a name being forced upon them as the Alliance of Unionism or the Union Steph. Alliance.
I can't see Alliance getting in there, Sean.
Well, I think looking at it, it's the only way forward, because They're called, well, if you look at it, unionism is fractured still. they know the need to come together. But whether it's the alliance of unionism or the alliance, the democratic alliance, or
Sean, I know you're doing this in good faith, but there will be DUP supporters throwing stuff at their radios. They're not big fans of alliance. So any mention of alliance in the title, I think, is a non-runner.
Let's be honest, they're not big fans of much.
That's very insular. No, that's my point. They're light and day between the DUP of the 1970s. Mick?
Isn't that just great for us Republicans, then?
I think, the idea of, say, moving towards something like the Democratic Party is they actually make the unionist part of it implicit rather than explicit.
Okay.
Which means that one of the issues that they have, and one of the why they keep self-defeating themselves, is retrenching back into the unionist trenches. Mm. Now, if you come to a settled view that Northern Ireland is no longer under any explicit or even implicit threat of its future membership of the union, then why make the cold centre of your party the defence of the union? Why wouldn't it be something else?
So, Mick, to cut to the quick here, you're saying don't even have unionist in the title.
Well, I'm saying that would be, if you were to do that, I mean, this is partly because Sean's raised it.
Yes.
I think doubling down on the unionist thing will only continue to alienate the new voters that they want to pull back in again. And unionism has been, even despite its high numbers of voters, it's been an unpopular thing to admit in polite company that you vote unionist, even if you are never going to vote anything else.
Because more and more people are living.
Let me finish the point. The more and more people of us, particularly in the East, are living amongst people in mixed company. Right, and so if you were to say, look, it's the Democrat Party or the Democratic Party of Northern Ireland, you would then be saying, look, you're opening the door to moderate Catholics who don't necessarily, certainly don't want to associate with unionism or explicit form of British nationalism, but could see themselves going along with a project that saw the prosperity of Northern Ireland as more of its primary thing, then you begin to see somewhere where you might be able to move into not simply holding what you have, but actually moving into the softer edges of nationalism.
Go ahead, is that Sean?
In there.
No, it's
sorry,
David.
No, it's David. Sorry, Mark. I mean, I think there's a danger there, and with respect to Mick, there is this narrative that unionism is almost a dirty word. And I mean, I don't see why that's the case. I mean, I have said, you know, publicly, I'm proud to be a unionist, proud to, you know, support Glasgow Rangers, support Linfield, all the various stereotypes that you know, Republicans want to basically do you down for. That doesn't make me a bad person. I'm a law-abiding citizen. I think there's a danger here in a narrative that we're getting into unionism's bad, everything else is good. I think what I would say, and maybe to assist what Mick's trying to say, is that I think the problem is for the DUP that they've feared change, and that's why, you know, the DUP nearly lost Gregory Campbell, based on the fact that if you look at the candidate that ran for the SDLP, Cara Hunter, you know, she's in her 20s, Gregory's his age, and with respect, you've got to be ahead of the change. You've got to have succession planning. Mm. And I think now where you see the amount of DUP MPs who may rightly or wrongly be on their last Westminster stint, where is the planning to say, here's he or she who will replace person X in that constituency? That's what the DUP really need to look into.
But we can deal with that another day. I want to deal with the name, David. I want to put you on the spot. Can you remember the Popular Unionist Party? What a name that was back in the 1990s. You're probably too young. Mick will be able to tell us who the leader was. Mick,
The Up-Ups. I remember the Up-Ups very well. Yep.
Who was the leader of the Popular Unionist Party?
I think it was Jim Kilfetter.
Jim Kilfetter, the late Jim Kilfetter. Like, what a name. Can you imagine that branding meeting? What will we call ourselves? The Progressive Unionist Party? No, the Democratic Unionist Party? No, I tell you what, it's going to be the Popular Unionist Party.
This is why, in a way, I didn't push the whole idea of a name change back, but it's the last thing on the agenda after the reorganisation, after the buy-in, after the figuring out what is your core What's your core purpose? Now the threat to the union is over. Now that Northern Ireland is beginning to become prosperous in spite of the lack of political action from the executive and others. Like, how are you going to, you know, David's exactly right. How are you going to embrace the future? How are you going to get to the future and then narrate people back into that space? Because that's an expansionary space. And in a way, the whole sort of lager mentality that we've had has just seen unionism in the DUP, certainly in latter years, begin to suddenly shrink.
Lager mentality in the DUP.
But the paradox is that unionism hasn't got any less popular vis-a-vis the popularity of nationalism. So in a way, it hasn't really lost the constitutional ground. And one of the points Lee makes in the piece is, you know, the union might well continue to prosper without the DUP, without the Ulster Unionists, without the TUV, just simply because in the settled position that we're in, 25 years, 26 years after the Good Friday Agreement, the place is beginning to take off. It's attracting people from other countries. Its universities are full, and there are new industries kind of filling the most of the east of Northern Ireland, as far as East Tyrone and East Londonderry. And there's something here to kind of, there's a stake in the future that is really worth kind of investing in.
Back to the lines. I think Dave is still there. Sorry for making you wait, Dave. Hello.
Good morning, Mark. How are you keeping? Are you keeping all right?
Rightly.
Dead on. Mark, listen, see the DUP, they can change the name, they can change the brand, they can change the colours. So the same DUP, no interest in working class British communities, and that's been over the decades, and I can tell you that now. Mark, I come from a sports background, and I tried to get an Andy Murray legacy project going. It's called the Andy Murray Olympic Tennis Centre at Ballyselling and Plainfields to save the last public courts in Belfast, right? 2021, that was put out, right? The Belfast City Council. Belfast City Council are going to demolish them courts, right? Now, I'll put this in perspective. We've only got 7 public tennis courts, hard courts in the whole of Belfast, the whole population right now. What that did, I spoke to a number of councillors. I'm going to name them. Dale Pankhurst.
Well, let's move on, Dave, from that. I want to put to David Graham this whole issue that the DUP has lost touch with the working class, as Dave referred to.
Look, I think Dave's entirely right. That's not, in my view, through the fault of some really strong representatives on the ground, the likes of Tracy Kelly in South Belfast, Frank McCubry up in northwest Belfast. The challenge is now that, you know, Mick's entirely right. He talks so much there about prosperity, and he's entirely right, and so many great things to celebrate. But as Mick said, where when people are moving out, when they're moving from inner city Belfast towards South Antrim, for example, people have been left behind. They've been left behind by our system. Not necessarily even just working class Protestants in particular, when you look at the education figures, but also wider context, people from all religious backgrounds and newcomers, that they have been left behind by the system. And I actually think because the DUP has been seen as the party of government, the party of the establishment, as Lee Reynolds mentioned, that then creates the situation that they are at fault. And to an extent, they are
still the biggest unionist party, David. By a mile.
There's no doubt about that. And I think that, you know, Gavin Robinson, when he sits down to make his speech for the weekend, there are still a lot of positives for the DUP. I mean, even everything that they've come through, where they've had leadership change and almost a leadership merry-go-round, they've had some other, you know, controversies and one thing or another that have played out in public. The reality of it is they are still standing. But I think that the big danger is, if you look at the demographic of people that are voting for the DUP, they, with respect, are getting older, and their children, and particularly their grandchildren, aren't coming out to be traditional DUP voters. And that's where, as Lee says, that's where change needs to occur. That's where evolution and development needs to occur, particularly over the next 3 years, because I think they're crucial to the future of party political unionism.
Yeah, and I think, look, the other thing I would say to the lack of engagement with working class communities, I think one of the key points that Lee makes in the piece is the decentralisation of power. Not every key decision has to be, I mean, every key strategic decision needs to be made at headquarters in Dundell Avenue in East Belfast. But there needs to be a devolvement of power so that when parts of the party in North Belfast or West Belfast or Inner East report back on specific policy issues that they're finding on the doorstep, that needs to be brought powerfully back into the centre with powerful advocates who get listened to rather than coming to a chief executive who isn't plugged into those power networks. And by the way, I'm not saying this specifically because it's the DUP's problem. I reckon if you look at almost any major political party across the United Kingdom, United States, and most of Western Europe, this is a thing that theoretically is supposed to happen, but isn't, because most of our modern political parties have hollowed out the whole sort of local presence, local engagement with ordinary people. Leaves people feeling, like Dave feels, that they're being left out.
What about the Democrat Progressive Party? We've got that as a suggestion. Let's ask Pat. Pat's on the air from Ballygasson. Hello, Pat.
Ballygasson, Mark.
Ballygasson?
Not to be correct, yes, sir.
Where is that? Where is that?
No, I'll tell you what I was thinking.
Sorry, Mark, where is it? Sir. Where is Ballygasson?
It's a small town land that runs alongside the Callan River in County Armagh.
Oh, lovely. Lovely. What's your point about the DUP, Pat?
Right. The point about the DUP I was going to suggest is that, that if I take a lead from a very famous man called Martin Luther, who wasn't happy with the way the church was being run at in his day. And he started, he was an original Protestant. But his revolution was called a Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggest that the new Unionist Party call themselves Reformation Unionists.
Reformation Unionists. Mm-hmm.
Or short, Reform for short.
Mm. Mm. David Graham?
Well, I think we're perhaps going down a pathway that we're not going to be able to solve in the next 3 minutes, Mark. I think once the DUP have been known for nailing themselves, pardon the pun, to the sort of Martin Luther and Lutheran viewpoint and policies when the party started as the Ulster Democratic Unionist Party under Dr. Paisley. So I think obviously that the name is one that you want to debate. But as I said, it's the players behind it, and it's what the players are doing that are key to any change. There's key to any change in Northern Ireland politics.
We have another suggestion here, the Royal Unionist Coalition.
Yeah, I think they might run into trouble with the Royal Family on that one. Mm. Look, DPP isn't going to cut it, any number of alphabet suits. Suggestions aren't going to cut it. It's the key thing. One of the things that the Ulster Unionists discovered, much to their pain back in 2010, is that just simply calling themselves the Conservative and Unionist Party just confused their voters. Because people were seeing that up on the street posters and going, who the hell are they? There's a certain kind of brand resilience in names that have been known for a long period of time. So I would caution any political party that wanted to dump, however wounded they think their brand is, that just one thinks that by dumping it, you get something better. You have to invest in what you've got, and you have to move towards the future.
Thanks, Mick Fealty. Thanks to David Graham, former special advisor at the DUP. Thanks for all your calls, all your texts today. Keep them coming. We're back tomorrow. Some things never change. The Nolan Show is here every weekday at 9 o'clock. Connor Phillips is next.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Show!